Nobody in the early church or Jewish thinking of the time believed that fallen angels are demons in the sense of what most people think.
I know the first time I heard this, I was like, what in the world? What do you mean demons are the half-breed children of angels? You're off your rocker.
We are highly evolved in the 21st century. We know everything. And those people that were before us are so foolish and superstitious.
Welcome to Kingdoms Unveiled, where two Reformed Baptist pastors are trying to pull back the curtain on the spiritual nature of our Bibles, where we're going to allow Christ's kingdom to be glorified, but at the same time, we're not afraid of talking about things like, well, today, demons, angels, and giants, and how they play into the redemptive story and how it affects not only our faith, but the advancement of the church. We're both men who believe in two kingdoms, where we live in a physical kingdom, and there is a spiritual kingdom at war. And what does the interaction of that look like? Like our brother Paul says, we're not wrestling against flesh and blood, but against a host of spiritual armies. And we want to engage one of that today on the podcast. Doug Van Dorn is the pastor of the Reformed Baptist Church in Northern Colorado. And I'm John Moffitt. I'm the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. And we both are churchmen. We're confessional churchmen. We both hold to the 1689. This is important for you to understand because often we're accused of being crazy, going against the Reformed faith, going against tradition. And in some ways, we are, because the tradition needs to be broken. But we're not going against our faith or our confession. And so that is important for us to state up front because we want to be known as men of the word and that we are just trying to help talk through some things in church history that I think either it's gotten confused or ignored. So, Doug, it's good to be on our second podcast today. We already did one on angels. Today is demons. So I already told you the question. I forgot it on last episode, but I remembered it on this one. So, Doug, you and I were laughing before recording. So I'm going to ask you it now. Do you, and being that you've been on Blurry Creatures and they've asked you this before, so I'm going to ask you more of a specific question. Do you think that Bigfoot, being that he's seen as beneficial at times, to humans, do you think Bigfoot's an angel?
Yeah, I mean, that kind of came up because you brought up the story of the missing children, and you think about David Politis talking about all these missing kids and stuff like that. And you said it was an angel, and I jokingly said, no, it's Bigfoot who's bringing them back. So is he, you know, is it Bigfoot bringing it back? I mean, I don't know. It's funny because I tend to think that probably Bigfoot is more demonic, although it's an interesting thing that he appears more neutral than anything else. He can be good, bad, or indifferent. And guess what? That's actually the way that the ancient Greeks thought about demons. They did not think of them as entirely evil. So, it's kind of actually an interesting segue into our topic.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll state this until I forget it, but they are deceitful. They're liars, which means they can appear, as Paul says, as angels of light. We'll get into that. So, Doug, we are going to talk about something that you and I both come from a conservative, Baptistic, and now Reformed, where the warning on this is, hey, guys, don't start thinking about this. You're going to open yourself up. You know, we don't need to focus on this. We need to focus on the gospel. And yet we ignore passages that Paul and Peter multiply point to saying this is a real problem and you need to be aware of it. And it's like, it's almost like demons are there, but we don't need to worry about it because Christ is the victor. Okay.
So and the way you put that is much more positive than the way I was thinking of it. Because the people, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say you should never even talk about that because you're going to become demon possessed for even talking about demons or reading about them. It's like, man, I'm pretty sure that's not the way that works.
Yeah, for sure.
If that was true, the Bible talks about it, then just to read the Bible means I'm going to get demon possessed. It talks about demons all the time. And it gives us warnings about that.
That's right. And there is a way to make, I don't think reading about is how to do it, but Paul does say, or James says, don't make a place for Satan. Don't give him, let him have a foothold. And I don't think it's reading about him. I think it's ignoring Christ in the gospel and not putting on the armor of God and standing in the strength of the Lord. And we'll save that for later. So this is an interesting subject. there's two sides of it too, Doug, right? So there's the side where they completely ignore it because it is weird. It's creepy. It's just creepy. It's weird. And at the same time, I think you've got the flip side where you have people who are demon hunting. They're trying to engage it. They're trying to find it, which I think is unbiblical. We'll
explain Buffy the Vampire well. Slayer.
There you go. There you go. So, and you know, there's some brothers out there who I respect and I love, but it seems like they're a little bit too fascinated with this in that they're pursuing it, trying to hunt it down. And I don't think that, I think if you preach the gospel and you live for Christ, Peter makes pretty clear, you're going to be engaging with a spiritual realm that you're going to suffer from it and you're not going to want it. You're not going to want its entity around you, which is the very reason why Paul tells us about the spiritual armor. So in this podcast, we want to take this serious. So let's talk about the perspective of this word demon and how it's like angel. It's kind of just thrown out there, right? It's used in such a way. So Doug, we're going to work backwards a little bit. We're going to actually kind of work from the New Testament backwards and talk about the people, what they're most familiar with as demons. But this is where the fun part comes in. You and I would say that the modern view of demons is not necessarily how the ancients would have thought about demons.
Yeah, not so, even slightly, actually. No.
So talk to us.
So, you know, first of all, I think that people, I said this at the beginning of the last show, we throw everything into like one of two categories, angels or demons. Mm-hmm. And so you mm-hmm. often hear that Satan is a demon. Or you'll hear that in the supernatural Genesis 6 view that the demons are the fallen angels. This is probably the most common view, is that the demon is a fallen angel. And what I want to say is right off the bat is no, nobody, literally, hear me well, nobody in the early church or Jewish thinking of the time believed that fallen angels are demons in the sense of what most people think. So we have to classify that, categorize it. So when, you know, we said we start with the New Testament. So there's a couple of terms that are being used in the New Testament. Demon is one of them. Evil spirit is another. Unclean spirit. Sometimes you'll get that. Sometimes just spirit. Mm-hmm. And so when we're talking about these unclean spirits, the universal view of this, and I made a big point to say that the universal view of the first three centuries of the church of Genesis 6 was mm-hmm. that it was a supernatural event, not a Sethite thing. Well, that's the same mm-hmm. thing that's true here of what an unclean spirit was. So I'll just give you a couple of quotes from the church fathers and then a couple from the Jews before Christ. So here's Justin Martyr, my favorite church father. But the mm-hmm. angels transgressed this appointment. Hear that? The angels transgressed this appointment and were captivated by love of women and begat children who are those that are called demons. That right there in a nutshell is the ancient view. Here's Eusebius, the great church historian. For one might say that these demons are those giants, Genesis 6:4, and that their spirits have been defiled by the subsequent generations of men, and that their battles and their quarrels among themselves and their wars are the subjects of these legends that are told as of gods. And when he's mentioning gods there, he's speaking of gods in the secondary sense, like Hercules or Perseus, not in the primary of somebody like Zeus or Hera. So it's the children of the Olympians is essentially what the view was. And then this is the same thing that you find with the Jews. So here's a first century book called The Testament of Solomon. Very, very weird book. All about demons and Solomon binding demons with magic rings. This is basically where Tolkien got it from. Yeah, it's fast. It's really interesting read. And he like enlists them to help him build the temple and stuff. But anyway, at one point in time, the demon answered. He says, "I am called Ornius. I'm an offspring of the archangel of the power of God. I am of an angel, and through the daughter of a man, I was born."
Wow.
Okay. And then you have Philo talking about that. And of course, you have First Enoch talking about that. Now, the giants who are produced from the spirits and flesh shall be called evil spirits upon the earth. and the earth shall be their dwelling. Evil spirits have proceeded from their bodies because they are born from men and from the holy watchers is their beginning and primal origin. And they shall be evil spirits on earth, and evil spirits they shall be called. So here in this case, you actually have spirit being referring both to the demon and to the heavenly father, the watcher. And that's a view that I actually had to modify in my original giant book, because I kind of thought the spirits will only refer to demons, but it doesn't. Spirits also refers to watchers. And in this case, the evil spirits or the unclean spirits are the product of the union. In other words, they are the Nephilim. Now, why would that be the case? Well, think about it. It's because you have, if you think about the mixing of kinds in Leviticus, don't mix two kinds of seeds or don't mix fields with two different kinds of things. Don't wear clothing in two different kinds of material. That's a mixing of kinds. Remember your Genesis 1 and your Genesis 7, 6 and 7, where God makes everything according to its kind. That is a clean thing. Now, not all things according to their kind are clean, but that's one basic idea, that if it's a mixture, it's by definition unclean. And this would be exactly what's going on in the way that they thought about this, is that you have a heavenly parent and you have an earthly parent. And so by definition, it's unclean spirit that is produced. Now, the spirit, of course, would be the immaterial part of the Nephilim, so that when it dies, the body goes into the ground like a human, but its spirit is not a human spirit. It's something else. It's the spirit of a Rephaim. And we'll talk about that word in a moment when we get into the etymology of a demon. But where do they go? Actually, Augustine, this is really interesting, because Augustine starts talking about in, I think it's book 8 through 10 in the City of God. This is interesting because he doesn't believe in the supernatural view of Genesis 6. But nevertheless, he talks about these demons and how because they're not from heaven and they're not from earth, they're actually from the middle. They're in the middle. They're the air. They end up being these creatures that haunt the air. Well, he's getting this from the writings of Hermes, kind of alchemetic sort of writings and stuff like that. But he's giving the worldview, which is really interesting, because it's not a hard step for you to go into the Genesis 6 thing, bro. They didn't do it. So. Anyway, that's the universal view of what an unclean spirit or a demon of the New Testament is. When we think of those things that possess people that Jesus and the apostles cast out of people, that's what you're to be thinking of primarily. All right?
Right. Right. Which Jesus uses that phrase, unclean spirits.
Yeah, exactly. But that's not all that the word demon means, but that is the primary thing an unclean spirit of the New Testament and the Gospels means.
So if you want more on this, which we haven't talked about this in a while, Doug, you mentioned your book, the book on giants, his 10th anniversary edition, where he updated it. There's a longer list of quotes that you can read that he's pulling that from. And so I would encourage you to go to read that, because there's more arguments that are there. We're just kind of condensing it down into this episode to introduce you to the concept of demons. So the idea of it, Doug, this is probably, I know the first time I heard this, I was like, what in the world? What do you mean that demons are the half-breed children of angels? You're off your rocker, right? There's no way that's what that means. But as you've quoted from Justin Martyr and all these other passages, but what about the Book of Enoch? Seems like a pretty big argument that these are definitely the children of the Nephilim. The Nephilim are the demons.
Right.
So do we want to talk about Enoch?
Yeah, now? I mean, I gave you a quote from Enoch. He was one of those guys that said that.
Oh, okay.
So this was just, this simply was the universal view. So we might think it's weird and bizarre, but that's because we're the ones who changed the view. Not that.
Right. And I want to make this argument based on it. This is why I was bringing Enoch back up. You have Jude, who's referencing the writings or referencing Enoch, and he's referencing this specific area of his book in relationship to the fallen spirits.
Yeah.
Right. So, Is Enoch inspired? No. We would not say that it's inspired. We would say that Jude's use of him, that section of it is. But if Jude felt that it was appropriate to quote Enoch and mention him as it relates to the integration between Elohim, these watchers, these angels, and humans creating Nephilim, this is what he's referencing, that their spirits are now in prison. As you keep reading Enoch, the very next section that you learn is that when these Nephilim died, when these beings died, they are the ones, according to Enoch, that became demons. So it's not, you know, sometimes people think you guys are just kind of pulling us out of thin air. This is, you know, mysticism of the early church where they were very ignorant. They were very, you know, they were finding spiritual problems or spiritual demons in everything.
Chronological snobbery, by the way.
Yeah,
is that C.S. Right. Lewis who made that term up, chronological snobbery, where we think because we are highly evolved in the 21st century, we know everything, and those people that were before us are so foolish and superstitious, right?
That was pretty good.
Thank you.
We need to turn that into a short. Yeah, turn that into a short, Charles. Put that out there. No, and this is, I think that looking at Jude, Peter also mentions the idea of the fallen watchers, and twice in 1 Peter and 2 Peter. So when you have the New Testament utilizing the book of Enoch specifically in this area, and the book of Enoch is telling us this is where demons come from. Because to be fair, Doug, there is no verse in the Bible that tells us where it comes from. Like, that's it right there. Is that fair?
But that's kind of a Trinity sort of an argument too. There's no verse that tells you the Trinity, but there's plenty of verses that get you to the Trinity. And the same thing is true, that there's plenty of verses that get you to this view of the giants.
That's my point. I was getting to the word concept fallacy. If the word isn't used, or if it's not specifically right there, then we're not going to.
I mean, just the very idea of an unclean spirit. If you know anything about your law in Leviticus and what unclean is, that right there gets you to it.
Yeah, a positive law where God posits upon something and says, therefore, this makes it wrong. All right, so this is a total off topic. I love doing this because it is fun to do this to you. But when it says that. Because, you know, a part of the story of the Watchers is that they were messing with humans, but they were also messing with animals, apparently, throughout this story. So when it says on the flood, when Noah brought each animal according to its kind, do you think that's there for a reason and a purpose?
Yeah.
And that there were other kinds of animals that had been unclean animals, that not necessarily the way that the Leviticus law talks about it, but that they were not of its original design.
Okay, so that gets us to something that's very interesting that is directly in the Bible, but again, it's kind of like you have to know what you're reading.
Right.
And you have to have a translation that's actually going to get you what you need to be reading, and some of them don't. So I'll just take two passages here. In Isaiah 34, verses 12 and 13, this is a prophecy against Edom. And then also in Isaiah 13, 21 and 22, this is a prophecy against Babylon, which you'll see why that matters in a minute. So these are parallel texts in Isaiah's literature. And here's what you have. You have in Isaiah 34, 11, you have and this is the ESV, you have hawks, porcupines, owls, and ravens. In the verse 13, you have jackals and ostriches. Verse 14, you have wild animals, hyenas, wild goats, and night birds. And in verse 15, you have an owl and a hawk. Okay, so if you go and you look up your Leviticus and what's a clean and unclean animal, these are all unclean animals. Okay, so they translate that way. But that's actually very rare, and I hope in their new updated version of the ESV that they change this. Man, I hope they do. Because when you go and read the Hebrew of some of these words, yes, some of them are unclean birds. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are unclean animals. Yes. But not all of them, because you have one animal that in the Hebrew is a tan. Now, this is best translated as a dragon, which is how the King James translates it. The Septuagint translates that as a siren. which is a half animal fish creature, and you know, it's your Little Mermaid. If you look at your Septuagint translation, they translate that as a monster. You have other words. The word ayim is translated as demonion or devils by the Septuagint. You have the word sair, which is translated as this, in the Septuagint, is an onokentauros or a satyr, a donkey centaur. And other translations that you'll find in the English are that will give you renderings for these words are like night monster, Lilith. Lilith is actually the Hebrew of one of those words. She was literally a vampiric creature who appears a couple places in the Old Testament.
Yeah, to listen to our episode on the monsters. We'll talk more
about that. You've got goat demons, night monsters, devils, howlings. I mean, in other words, this is really weird stuff in the original languages. Now, here's what I like to do to people when they go, well, you're just making that up. Or the Septuagint's just pulling that out and there's no legitimate reason for it. And what I want to say is, oh no. Oh no, John. Because we have an inspired commentary on this in the book of Revelation from the Apostle John. And remember, I said one of those is the Babylon. And this is why that matters. Revelation 18, starting in verse 1. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory. And he called out with a mighty voice, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Okay, Babylon the Great. Now, if you go and read like G.K. Beale's commentary or any good Reform commentary on Revelation, they will point out how much of Revelation is coming from the Old Testament. In fact, I have in my Old Testament handbook, companion volume that I just put out, I have a whole section in there on Old Testament quotes from that are used by John in Revelation. Very helpful little thing. But anyway, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, for she has become a dwelling place for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, and a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast. Well, guess what? Where's he getting that from? He's getting it from exactly the passage that I just read in Isaiah 13. He ain't making that up. He literally tells you that Babylon has become a haunt for demons. And when you start looking into it, you start seeing that this word demon is now being expanded from not just a human angelic creature hybrid to some sort of a, you know, we don't even know, man animal hybrid or angel animal hybrid or all three of them hybrid. We don't know. In the mythology, that's what these creatures are. Of course, the natural question people always want to ask is, so do you think that they're real or that they were real? And my answer is, I don't know. I mean, I've never heard that we found any kind of bodies or whatever. And maybe they just exist on the other side or something. We don't know, but we do know that the Bible takes them seriously and it talks about them in several different places. And it always talks about them as demonic creatures, which fits the exact idea that we began with, which is that a demon is an unclean, half-breed kind of a creature in the sense that we're talking about and in the sense you're asking about with the animals.
Right. Yeah, so there's like a, and in some of these questions I'm going to ask you, there's really not even an answer to it. But you know, when we're thinking about the capacities of the other realm and how it's brought, if they had powers in those realms and those, and then are now brought over into this realm, it can get very strange very quickly. You know, you even have in the story of Jesus when he's casting out the unclean spirits out of a man and it goes into a herd of pigs. Fascinating. Like, well, apparently animals can be controlled by an unclean spirit. Do with that what you want. I mean, there are times where we call it rabies, but maybe it's not rabies. Maybe it is something else. You know?
That's where, and I'm not trying that to story's so weird because and it actually points to something that you read about in the book of Jubilees. Which is just gives another, it's kind of they call it that the little Genesis. So it's about 70% Genesis and about 30% Jewish oral tradition. And they talk about actually the demons before the flood and how God said, I'm going to wipe them all out, and I'm going to utterly destroy them all and bind them into the pit of hell. And so then all of a sudden you get this demon creature, I think it's Mastema, which is actually another name for the devil. And he starts arguing with God, and he goes, well, if you do that, then the men aren't going to have anything to tempt them. And so then God says, fine, I'll let a tenth of them not be cast into the pit of Sheol. Now, what's so interesting about that is that it means 9/10 of those original Nephilim, according to this view, were thrown yep. into the abyss. So guess what? Guess what the demons in the Legion story don't want to be thrown into? Don't cast us into the abyss. And so Jesus says, fine, I'll throw you into the herd of pigs. And guess where the pigs go? They go into the metaphorical abyss of the Sea of Galilee. And so they end up getting exactly what they didn't want anyway. It's like very funny.
What, is there any connection? I should have asked you this ahead of time. In Matthew 12:43, when he says, when the unclean spirit has gone out of a person, it passes through waterless places.
Absolutely.
Seeking rest. Yeah,
a lot of us think that that is hearkening back to this original punishment I just talked about, where they were thrown into this water full place. You know, Sheol is a pit of water it's a dry place, but it's surrounded by the water, and it's a, you know, that's the, where everybody went. We talked about that in Hades. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. But that's the geography of the place. And the idea that you're getting there is that they were drowned, right? And so these guys are like, stay far away from water. We're going to hang out in the desert, right? As far away from the water as we can get, because we don't want to get punished like they did.
Oh, interesting. There you go. That is fascinating. All right. So, man, we have gone here, there, and everywhere. So the point of it being, when going back to my arc, because some of you are like, well, finish the arc thing, you guys. So it's very possible that during the time of the Nephilim in Genesis 6, that the Chronicles of Narnia was taking place, but not in a good way, in a bad way, with all of these mixture of beings.
What do you think about dinosaurs personally? Talk about it. Do you think men walk with dinosaurs?
It's so, I mean, it seems like there's some evidence of it, right? I mean, you got some of these footprints of humans and dinosaurs, they're cast in the same location.
The reason I ask is because there's a very interesting theory, and you actually get this in kind of Jurassic Park sort of stuff, but Christians have played around with this, that dinosaurs were actually unclean creatures, that they were
they
were actually a hybrid creature that was somehow made not by God, but by something else. And so the reason why they didn't make it on the flood is because God said, you're not going to get on the ark because you didn't belong here in the first place. And so, you know, that would be another explanation for why, like, if and I'm not going to die on this hill at all, but if there was like satyrs and whatever that were taking physical form, they didn't make it through the ark because they were unclean and they didn't belong here in the first place.
Right. Right. Well, and I'm curious too about when Israel is told to wipe out certain tribes, these Nephilim tribes, and it says including the animals, like if there is still some kind of weird practice going on.
I don't necessarily have a problem with that. A lot of people do. I've spent a little bit of time in the Giant Book on this, just explaining that, look, people don't have any idea what we're doing today, John, with regard to DNA manipulation and how we are creating animal-human hybrids in laboratories today. It's the island of Dr. Moreau, and it is real. It is happening. Mm-hmm. We have laws forbidding the practice. You don't create a law forbidding the practice if it can't be done. And my thought has been, and there's reasons why I think this beyond just this, but look, the angels have been around for a long, long time. And if they're fallen and they have knowledge and they're the ones who give us knowledge in some sense in the past and maybe also in the present, who's to say that they couldn't have done something like that back in those days?
Well, that kind of goes back to a little bit of our episode on the giants, where it talks in the Book of Enoch. This is what you're referencing, right?
Yeah.
Where they brought us knowledge about metallurgy and roots and painting of the eyes for seduction.
Yeah.
I always think that one's funny. Don't paint that barn, ladies. It's demonic. It's just such a bad phrase. All right. So going back to it, this has been a little bit more on the, you know, fringe side of things. We'll bring it back
let's do one more thing here because we never really got into this, which is the where does the word demon come from?
Right. Thank you. That's where I wanted to go back to.
Yeah. Thanks. So we looked at angel last time. We saw that it means a messenger. So the word demon is of an unknown origin. And there's several that have given possible derivations for it. So Plato thinks that it derives from the Greek word daemon, which means knowing. So it's a knowing one. If you've ever read or seen read a book on exorcisms or seen a movie on exorcisms, you see that these creatures seem to know things that they can't possibly know, which is terrifying. And you'll see that one in the third definition here in a minute.
Well, yeah, you see that in practice in the book of Acts when Paul's talking about this girl who has a capacity to tell the future.
That's right. That's right. It's like, where does that come from? And then when he casts out the demon, it's gone and everybody's ticked off because now they can't make any money.
That's right. I mean, it's right there in the text, though.
Anyways, keep going. Homer derives it from the word daimon, which means divinity. Now, this is interesting because this allows you to see that the Greeks actually used the word demon for anything that was a divinity. Okay. So we started off saying that they're animal. The New Testament refers to them really as animal or human hybrids. But you could also refer to them in some sense as even the watchers themselves. Now, this happens very rarely, but I do think we do see it. So, for example, in Psalm 96:5, in many translations, it'll say, for all the gods of the peoples are idols. And this is actually a verse that people will use to say that there's no difference between the first and second commandment, which we've talked about.
Makes no sense.
Well, the word there is actually elalim, which means technically it means worthless. So the gods of the nations are worthless. Not idols. Idols is a terrible translation. It's not the word pestle, which is what is in the second commandment. I don't even know where people get that from. But whatever. Do I get ticked enough, you know, with these kinds of things?
I love it.
So the Greek, the Greek translation actually has this. For the gods of the heathens are devils. Demonia. And I like the old English of Wycliffe. For alle the goodness of the heathen man ben fiendes. In other words, they are fiends.
That's
the 1388 Wycliffe Bible, which is taking it from the Vulgate. But yeah, the gods of the heathens are fiends. But the point is, this verse is talking about the gods of the nations. Well, that's the watchers. And so in translating that as devils or demons, it's actually using this in the broader sense that Homer used it for a divinity. Now, Eusebius derived it from a third word, daimenin, which means to fear. And so this is why people are always afraid of these creatures, and that's its derivation. And then most modern dictionaries derive it from the word deo, meaning to divide destinies. So then you get the idea of fate or the ability of the spirit to control your fate. You know, we just don't know what the etymology is, but all of them bring interesting things to the table. The idea of knowing, fearing, dividing destinies. A lot of times these creatures are said to be neither good nor bad nor indifferent. Actually, Augustine brings that out. Well, like you don't worship a demon because you can't trust it. It can come across as very helpful or whatever. They can actually heal people, which is very interesting because the word Rephaim, which is one of the synonyms for a Nephilim in the Old Testament, actually comes from the word meaning to heal. Okay, so that could be another idea of a demon going on there, and so.
Well, that was even the accusation against Jesus that he was practicing healing by
of
the power
of Beelzebub, right? And casting out demons by Satan, casting out demons. That's exactly right. So lots of things are going on with demons. Our view of it is pretty truncated in the 21st century with conservative Christianity. Yeah. And what we want to see, help people see, is that it's a lot richer worldview in the old in the old Greek world and Jewish world and early Christian world. There's a lot more we can talk about. I suppose demon possession next time, but
yeah, for sure. Well, to kind of go back and clean some stuff up here for a little bit. A couple of things that you said I think are important. First of all, the Old Testament has the word translated at times, a couple of times. In ESV, it's like three times it uses the word demon. And so I think the word, we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, Doug, that the word at times is used broadly, like this is demonic, not meaning that there's an unclean spirit, an actual like unclean spirit involved in it, as much as that it's part of the this realm yeah. of yeah. evil. Yeah. And I think the Old Testament, maybe that's why they use that translation that is there. A couple of ones that I had asked you about earlier, but Deuteronomy 32 is probably an example of that, of one that we've talked about before, where it mentions that they sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods they had never known. So in that particular, you were talking about this in the translation. So explain to us what is... I mean, are we dealing with these Nephilim? Is that what the writer of Deuteronomy is talking about? Or?
So this particular instance, they sacrificed the demons. I think it's best to translate it this way. I get this from Heiser's work. They sacrificed mm-hmm. the demons that were not God, capital G-O-D, as opposed to that mm-hmm. were no gods. Because that falls prey to this idea that they're really not anything. They're actually just idols. That's not what's going on here. Because the very next line says, to gods they had never known. In other words, of course they're gods. They're Elohim. Mm-hmm. They're demons. They're Elohim. That's used in synonymous with each other. Now, the word...
So, real quick, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, thank you. The word Elohim.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So, that's the word Elohim. So, Elohim is used in it's synonymous to demon here. But the word demon here is not demonion. It's the word shedu. Now, this mm-hmm. is actually very closely related to the gods of the nations idea, the allotment, the inheritance that we've talked so much about. And what's fascinating is that Paul actually is getting his discussion in 1 Corinthians 8 through 10 from this passage. He says, I don't want you to be sacrificing to demons. Remember this? And so in that case, he's not referencing the evil spirits of the Gospels. He's referencing the gods of the nations, such as Zeus, that people would, or Athena, or whoever, you know, Artemis, that they would sacrifice their meat to these creatures, just like you'll see in the book of Leviticus, where the priests will offer this bowl or whatever to the Lord. But then it's not like they just burn the food. No, they eat the food because it's been sacrificed to God and now it's been made holy. And what Paul's dealing with is people, they were doing this around the ancient world and they would do it to these other gods, not the evil spirits, but the higher entities. And so in that case, it's another example of how demon doesn't necessarily mean an evil spirit or an unclean spirit, but it can actually refer to the parents, the watchers, the Elohim themselves.
Right. So I think it's good to maybe even think about, we're kind of bringing this together. So if you go back to our episode on the gods, we would say the spirit realm, to which the realm that God is in, is the creatures that are there are described as Elohim, which, you know, we try to explain that. And then it seems to be that in the fallen dark realm, the spirit of darkness, the creatures that are there are titled demons, which could be a watcher, a fallen watcher, or it could be an unclean spirit. It seems to be used in both. So it's basically context has to drive what, same thing like in Elohim, going back to, you know, we're talking, you said, you made a statement, Doug, and this might be, if someone's just new to this episode, they're looking up demons and they watch this and they're like, what do you mean it should be translated God? Well, Elohim is plural.
Right.
So it could be referring to the God of gods or it could be referring to the gods and the context. And this is what you're saying. The context is driving it to be, Because even when it says that Yahweh is the God of gods, it is Yahweh is the Elohim of Elohim, is what the phrase says. So you have to look at it in a context. It's not going to be the gods of gods, and it's not going to be the God of God. There's a context that has to drive that. And so when we're looking at it in its context, and the reason why I'm making a whole hubbub about this is that we will embrace the idea of there being demons in a person, but not there being powers in an idol. And that is how it's being referenced. That's how Paul is understanding it. So he's not saying that there is a Nephilim necessarily in an idol, but the power of a fallen watcher or the power of an Elohim that is in rebellion is what they're making these sacrifices to, and they're not inanimate objects that don't exist. So this is why this subject becomes important, because when Paul's talking about you're not wrestling against flesh and blood, we're trying to help you flesh this out a little bit, in that we are engaging in a war with real entities that have real powers. Thoughts?
Yeah, we're not making this up. I mean, when I give you that translation and I go against the ESV, don't get all mad about that, because the King James Version says they sacrifice to devils, not to God, to gods they had not known. The Septuagint translates it that way. The Vulgate translates it that way. So, yes, the ESV and a few other contemporary versions translate it as gods, but that's just the ambiguity of the word, and you have to let the context determine it. And like we said, how can you translate it as they were no gods when the very next word says that they are gods? I don't understand what goes through people's heads.
It is that. Well, it is funny when you read in the ESV, it's like they're no gods to gods. And I'm like, so are they or are they not? This is very strange. Exactly. Yeah. So what we're hopefully doing is giving a little bit of pulling back the structure and saying, okay, when word is demons used, let's think about context. You know, if it's Old Testament, what is it referencing? If it's New Testament, typically the word unclean spirit's going to be a reference to these Nephilim. If it's talking about making sacrifices to demons, we're probably going to be referencing
if it's talking about one more we haven't talked about is how there's doctrines of demons, right? And that,
thank you, that was the last
that's
one
an interesting one, because we're not really sure, because this could be coming through the demonic entities that possess people or whatever. So in that sense, it could be an evil spirit, but it could also be coming from the watchers themselves, who, you know, according to all the ancient traditions, are the ones who taught us things. So in that case, it could be, it's ambiguous. It could be any kind of a supernatural evil creature that is telling the church things that are contrary to the Holy Scripture.
That's right. Paul is worried about this. Now, the Spirit expressly says that in latter times, some will depart from the faith by devoting themselves to deceitful spirits and teachings of demons. So he uses two different explanations there, right? And so in that context, you know, I think it's fair to say, I don't know if it's talking about the watchers.
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
Right. Through the insistery of liars whose conscience are seared, who forbid marriage and required abstinence from food that God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. By the way, I believe and know the truth. And all of you who tell me that some of the foods that I'm eating are unhealthy and bad for me, I tell you that's the doctrine of demons.
You can die of a heart attack at 55 if you want.
No, my point of it is I think it's hilarious how everything changes. Like, only eat vegetables, don't eat bacon and eggs. And now it's like, eat as much as you can. Don't eat vegetables. Yeah. You know, and I was like, yo, that's the doctrine of demons. We all know what you're talking about, man. Crazy people. A couple of passages that are related to this that I want to bring up is 2 Timothy chapter 2 verse 24 says, and the Lord's servants must not be quarrelsome, but kind to everyone, able to teach, patiently enduring evil, correcting his opponents with gentleness. God may perhaps grant them repentance, leading them to a knowledge of the truth, and they may come to their senses and escape from the snare of the devil after being captured by him to do his will. I mean, think about that for a moment. This is the part of the demonic theology that we're trying to point out, in that this isn't just for fun to talk about weird creatures or to go on witch hunts or to go. Paul is concerned that if we're not proclaiming the gospel, they're going to get captured by the enemy. This is a serious thing. right? So being involved in a church that's proclaiming the gospel, that's caring for one another, that's taking serious the sacraments, the Lord's table, prayer, confronting each other, confessing of sins, all of this is a part of the war against a real entity and real problems. And it's not just for fun so that we can have a paranormal show, right? Another one, this is Ephesians chapter 4, verse 25. Is there, it says, therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth to his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down upon your anger, and give no opportunity for the devil. Right? These are interesting statements. So apparently, the way in which we interact with each other and we engage with each other, speaking the truth and not harboring anger, if we do the opposite of that, somehow he doesn't really tell us.
A great point, because it's not just the doctrines that can be evil. It is our behavior that can be evil. And you can have all the right doctrine in the world. If you do not behave the way you're supposed to, that is just as demonic, if not perhaps more demonic than the getting the doctrines, especially when it's doctrines that you can argue about. And we're not, you know, I've seen so much in our circles of people making these mountains out of these molehills that, you know, we're not talking the level of creeds. We're talking the level of parsing, you know, philosophical terms that people have disagreed on for years, and you're only allowed to do it in one way. And then the way that people behave, John, and I've seen it firsthand, it's reprehensible. And it's like the Ten Commandments aren't doctrine for some reason. I don't understand that.
Well, even when James, when I think it's interesting in that phrase, and I have mentioned in the past, like, what does he mean by that? I think in context, I know what he means. When James says, resist the devil and he will flee from you, I think it has everything to do with what he has just said. Yeah. Our conduct, our mouth, the way in which we utilize or hurt people or create caste system. You go sit over there because you're wealthy and you go over here. This is what he just got done saying. He goes, resist that. That's demonic. That's devilish. That's of Satan. And if you resist that in the context, not in your life, but in the context of the church and how you treat each other, he's not going to have a place in your congregation. But if you don't do that, what's the number one thing he wants to do? Destroy the church. Therefore, it destroys the mechanisms of the advancement of the gospel, and he gets to stay out of the prison for a little bit longer. So there is a legitimate reason why the army of the evil one wants to fight us, because, well, they get to stay out as long as it. And for whatever reason, that's how God's designed it, right? Their day of judgment comes at the same day of judgment as human. So it's all the same day of judgment. And therefore, our advancement of the gospel, we can't get lazy about it. Be sober-minded. Be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, put on the whole armor of God. Be renewing your mind, right? Be washing it constantly. Consider how to build one another up, because it's a real war, a real problem. And demons aren't just fun to think about. And it didn't, as some, we've talked about this, Doug, it's not like the activity died when Jesus rose from the grave. And it's like, it's all over now. This is not the case. So it's fun to have an idea of where these creatures come from. I think it's interesting to talk about the giants. But in the end, Doug and I are trying to help you understand Genesis 6 is very much connected to these passages that we're reading here. It's just the backstory. It's just a little bit more color and helping you understand. It's real, it's important, and it plays into your daily life. Doug, any other thoughts before we close it down? A little bit longer today.
No, that was good. I think it's important subject. For reasons that people don't understand. Yeah. So hopefully we've clarified some things.
All right. So we made a couple of passages like don't give place for the devil, or this one here, captured by him to do his will. Now, Doug, I'm telling you right now, he's talking about Christians. In Timothy, 2 Timothy chapter 2, and they come to their senses and escape from the snare of the devil after being captured by him to do his will. You know what that sounds like, Doug? Demon possession of a Christian.
Stay tuned for the next episode.
That was good. That was good. All right. We're next week when you come back, we're going to talk more about this very strange subject and see if we can offer some light in it. I'll tell you right now, there's a lot of hope because the power is always in the gospel. But there's definitely a warning here, and how should we understand these warning passages about something I think is maybe a little confusing. So stay tuned. We'll see you next week.